DW Deutsche Welle. Worldlink.
Hello and welcome to DW's Worldlink, bringing you the personal stories behind the headlines. In Bonn, Germany, I'm Neil King.
And I'm Natalie Muller.
On this week's show,
we meet the Maltese philanthropist who's saving migrants at sea.
Why xenophobia is rampant in South Africa's townships.
These attacks now question this. How united are South Africans really? How resolved are the issues? It now may not be so much issues between black and white, but issues between those who have and those who have not.
And the Liberian who's fighting Ebola at the border.
These stories and more coming up on Worldlink. You're listening to DW's Worldlink, bringing you the personal stories behind the headlines. In Bonn, Germany, I'm Neil King.
And I'm Natalie Muller.
Today, I think we gave a strong reaction from the European Union side. Today, we have a new European level of awareness that this is a European issue, not of single member states.
That was EU Foreign Policy Chief Federica Mogherini responding to the catastrophic shipwreck that killed up to 900 migrants off the coast of Libya on April 19th. The incident, which has raised the official death toll of migrants dying in the Mediterranean to around 1,800 so far this year, has renewed pressure on the EU to find a common policy on migrants who are risking their lives in a bid to reach European shores.
EU leaders gathering for emergency talks in Brussels on Thursday agreed to triple funding for the bloc's Triton Sea Patrol mission, which was launched late last year after Italy's wider-reaching Mare Nostrum programme was scrapped. The mission's budget is now 120 million euros, in line with the funding that backed Mare Nostrum. Leaders also discussed strengthening the EU's maritime presence and potential military operations to fight people smuggling networks in Libya.
But there are some who feel it's their duty to act despite what the EU might decide. For instance, the couple Regina and Christopher Catrambone. These philanthropists based in Malta launched Europe's first privately run offshore migrant aid station last year. Since then, they've helped save over 3,000 people with their ship Phoenix One, which is equipped with drones and rescue boats. They are now joining forces with Doctors Without Borders and are setting out to sea again on May 2nd. Worldlink interviewed Regina last year following the launch of the project, and we contacted her again earlier this week to get her reactions to the recent catastrophe.
We are shocked and we are really concerned about the situation. The first 3 months of 2014, when from January till March only 14 people died out at sea, the number of from January till March 2015 where over 500 people died. So last year in 60 days out at sea, we cooperate to the rescue of 3,000 people. Last year was a different situation though. We were out at sea with the mission Mare Nostrum, so you can understand that there were more boats out at sea, more assets out at sea.
Do you know what has happened to these people? Where are they now?
Of course, they were disembarked, all of them, in Italy. We give them over to the Red Cross and the Italian military.
You must come into close contact with these people, obviously, when you rescue them. What sort of stories do these people tell you?
They are desperate. They are scared. They were the women. Most of them are pregnant because during this difficult trip, before to arrive even to the African shore, they were raped. They were abused. When they see us, we are the first people that just want to help them without having nothing back.
Mm-hmm. Given the history of these people, that a lot of them come from conflict zones, war zones. How do you respond to people who say migrants who drown at sea in overcrowded vessels only have themselves to blame?
Every one of us has ethical and moral responsibility, and every one of us has a heart. We'll suggest to go there with a boat and tell, oh, you need to die, you need to blame yourself. Tell them in the face. For me, it's something crazy, it's insane, it's not possible to do it.
This latest disaster, it has rekindled the European debate on how to deal with migrants trying to reach European shores. What is your personal take? How should Europe respond?
I'm a positive person. I believe in Europe. I believe on the people that daily work in the European government. I hope that now that all these people die, they can have a further push to find a solution, even in Africa. And, of course, we know that this is not the solution to save them only in the sea. But this is one solution. And we don't need only to think about Europe, about Italy, about Malta. We need to think about why they are leaving their country. And as long as the drivers of migration persist, and migrants and refugees will continue to undertake this perilous journey, we need to protect them. We need to shelter them.
That was Regina Catramboni, the co-founder of the Migrant Offshore Aid Station, or MOAS for short.
Now, we just heard from somebody who's actively engaged in the rescue of migrants trying to cross the Mediterranean to reach European shores. But how do Africans living in Europe feel about the tragedy and the European response to it? Assumpta Lattis is from Tanzania and works at DW's English for Africa department. She gave us her very personal take in this postcard.
Every time I hear the words Mediterranean or Lampedusa, I shiver and I feel sad. That's because I know that more of my people, fellow Africans, are going to be involved in the latest tragedy or are being buried on the rocky shores of European outposts. Perhaps you might be expecting me as an African to feel angry with Europe, as Europe itself seems to be. But I'm angry at African governments for not doing more. What I find strange is that no one else, at least in Europe, seems to expect African governments to take part in a solution to this crisis. Europeans often say they need to find solutions, they need to make the place these immigrants come from better. But they don't ever seem to hope or expect the African governments to help them find that solution. Africans don't need European pity. What they need is to be expected to step up to the plate. Europe benefits from much of the misery and low wages in many African countries, sure. Fishermen plunder the once vibrant waters around Africa. Cocoa, fruit, vegetables and flowers are all grown on our continent and shipped to Europe and the world. Yet no one wants Africans following the products exported from our continent. Since Europe began to address this crisis, they have held only one meeting about it in Africa, in Kigali. And I, for one, wonder whether any of the recommendations that came out of that meeting will ever really be addressed. I believe this crisis needs to be Africa's problem for anything really to be solved. I feel ashamed of being African and ashamed of governments from my continent. The biggest challenge facing us is to change how Africans think about Europe. It is not the earthly paradise. For many of them, it is a living hell. I have met Africans who live in Europe and work for $3 a day or less. They sleep rough, sell illegal goods and are exploited or forced to work in dangerous jobs or as prostitutes. Their lives once in Europe are often worse than those they left behind at home. Europe is still a place of prejudice for many Africans. When I lived in Italy, where I studied at university, men would often side up to me and ask me how much I cost for the night. What I want to tell my fellow Africans is to stop thinking that Europe will solve your problems. You will most likely end up living in shanty towns here too. It is time now to wake up and work out a way for everyone to make it in their own countries, instead of building castles in the sky, which don't and can't really exist.
Thanks to our DW colleague Assumpta Lattis there for that postcard.
Oh, yeah. as these sounds from a vigil against xenophobia held on Tuesday in Johannesburg, South Africa, prove, migration is also a big issue inside Africa. Johannesburg's townships have been witnessing a wave of xenophobic violence that has claimed the lives of at least 7 immigrants. The army has been deployed to support a police crackdown on the perpetrators who have been targeting immigrants from Zimbabwe, Malawi, Mozambique and other African nations.
The recent spate of attacks has revived memories of the xenophobic bloodshed in 2008 that left 62 people dead and which tarnished South Africa's post-apartheid image as a rainbow nation of different groups living together in harmony. Earlier, I spoke to our Johannesburg correspondent Dagmar Witek, who was at the vigil. I started by asking her to describe the event.
Well, people who came to the vigil at Constitution Hill in town here in Johannesburg, they came to show their disgust and their shock about the xenophobic and Afrophobic attacks in recent weeks and days. It was a great show of solidarity for immigrants who live and work here. It was also a sign of respect for those who lost loved ones, as only within the last 10 days, 7 people were killed by these attacks. I would have thought it's a lot more people coming out. I'd guess it was maybe around about 1,000 people there on Constitution Hill. Hundreds of candles were lit. The national anthem, which is in several local languages, was sung. And there were lots of posters and handmade signs held up which read, "No to xenophobia. This is not what we fought for. Shame on us." And also, which is something I really like, "Before we are South African, we're African. Before we're African, we're human." The atmosphere at the vigil was rather sad, as most people feel disbelief. Most feel speechless and to an extent also, I think, helpless at this outbreak of violence, hate and injustice. What was nice to see, though, at the vigil was that really it was people from all walks of life who'd come out. It was young people, old people, black and white, getting together and voicing their feelings.
It's disgusting. It's completely disgusting.
I feel it's unfair, and especially what in the past we fought for, and now it's coming back again because it's the same. We're discriminating against our brothers.
We need to stand up as SA and say no to xenophobia, no to discrimination in any form.
Okay, Dagmar, as we just heard, people at the vigil wanted to make a public statement by saying no to xenophobia. I mean, it's not really a new phenomenon. There have been a string of xenophobic attacks in South Africa over the past decades. In 2008, for instance, 62 people were killed in Johannesburg's townships. And the army was also sent in back then to restore order. Why do you think is this whole problem cooking up again now?
I'd say simply because the issues were not dealt with appropriately. These waves of attacks flare up in densely populated areas, mainly in the townships, but also in inner Johannesburg, where there is a lack of services, so often no water or electricity, where people live on top of each other, where there are also a lot of informal settlements or in town so-called hijacked houses. It's areas where poverty is huge. Bear in mind that according to official South African statistics, 37% of the population are considered as living below the breadline, and these are the official statistics. And the violence is also occurring in areas where the unemployment rate is sometimes as high as 75%. So these factors all together make up a dangerous and explosive mix. Here's what some of the people at the vigil see as their cause or the cause of the problem.
Job insecurity, lack of education, poor service delivery. To me, it's people taking up their frustrations on what government has failed to do and putting the blame on others who are willing to do something better their lives. They're just shifting blame, basically.
I think that people are desperate and misplacing their frustration and anger. And they are desperate because the government has failed them. They're still poor, they don't have decent homes, services, education, life is not better.
Okay, so the key words there are very much poverty, lack of opportunity and the desperation that results from it. So the government has a fair share of responsibility here, but isn't there also a deeper level here to the underlying issue? I mean, is there any indication that apartheid-style thinking has rubbed off on some of South Africa's black population who are now beginning to discriminate against others themselves?
Not necessarily that, but South Africans have definitely not dealt with the trauma that apartheid inflicted to inflict it upon them. And this is why it is such a volatile and violent, or I always call it sick society. In addition, though, studies have been done recently and several established that South Africans tend to be surprisingly racist and nationalistic. One study found out that almost 65% of the population actually hold grudges and or reservations against foreigners. This may sound surprising in a country that managed to rather peacefully come together after the fall of apartheid and unite as one nation and one country. But these attacks now question this. How united are South Africans, really? How resolved are the issues? It now may not be so much issues between black and white, but issues between those who have and those who have not. The social gap between poor and rich is nowhere as big as is in South Africa. Also, what the situation now shows is that how people resolve conflicts or deal with problematic situations. It's not a given 21 years after Peace Nobel laureate Mandela was elected. The society still, I think, has a very long way to go to unite and learn how to resolve grave problems peacefully.
DW correspondent Dagmar Wittek talking to me from Johannesburg, South Africa there.
Global 3000 is DW's TV magazine exploring the opportunities and risks of globalization. Explore your world and watch us weekly online at dw.de/English/Global3000.
Staying in Africa, we now turn to an issue where migration can also be lethal, albeit for different reasons. Ebola. The only effective measure to stop this highly contagious disease from spreading is the strict quarantine of patients and close monitoring of the affected areas. According to the World Health Organization, more than 26,000 people have been infected with Ebola over the past 16 months. 11,000 have died. The countries worst hit are Liberia, Sierra Leone and Guinea.
Although the situation has improved since December, the WHO this week issued a stern warning that the decline in confirmed cases appears to have stagnated, urging affected countries to step up their anti-Ebola efforts and vigilance. New cases have been reported in Sierra Leone and Guinea in the third week of April, but Liberia, once the hardest-hit country, seems to have shaken off the disease. If no new cases are reported, Liberia should be declared Ebola-free by May. That is two incubation periods after the burial of the last confirmed victim.
But health workers aren't celebrating just yet. As long as the outbreak in neighbouring Guinea and Sierra Leone is not contained, Liberia is still in danger. Laura Salm Reifershaid has this report from the Liberian border with Guinea.
This end is Liberia. Across there is Guinea.
Emmanuel Dwe works as a surveillance officer for the health authorities in the district of Bong in Liberia. For nearly a year, the slim gentleman has been at the forefront in the fight against Ebola in his country. On this Sunday morning, he's visiting one of the border crossings between Liberia and neighboring Guinea. He's standing at the bank of a narrow river. In its shallow waters, men and women are washing their clothes. One young man is cleaning his motorbike. Every now and then, people pass to the other side over a makeshift bamboo bridge. The border official that stands next to Emmanuel does not check any passports. For the locals living close to the river, the border has little authority.
Guinea and Liberia, we are just the same. Because these people, we are during common interaction. We are interrelated. Now, these women have relationship with people in this village. Somebody dies here in this village. Everybody from this village will go there, because they have some relationship with the person. The same thing, if somebody dies, people from here will come here. So it's very hard to say, do not come to visit us. Even if they want to see the relative, they will pass the other way.
To Emmanuel, this is a cause of great distress.
They should learn to protect one another. Ebola is not about whether you are a Guinean and whether you are a Liberian. Ebola is about the person who has the potential to spread the disease, to prevent it from other communities, from other countries. Even though Liberia had discharged the last case of Ebola in the country, that is not enough. We are still having cases of Ebola in Guinea. Because once you pass through this checkpoint with elevated temperature or suspected case and you go into the community, you are going to make further contact and it will be another disaster for Liberia.
Back in March 2014, the virus came to Liberia from Guinea. As a result, nearly 4,500 people died. Emmanuel still remembers the night when he heard that first cases of Ebola had been discovered in Guinea.
I woke up from bed and I did not sleep. I started to worry that we are coming to get into trouble.
So now it is essential to prevent another spillover from the neighboring countries.
Your body temperature is 36.5 degrees Celsius.
Good morning. How are you doing?
Fine.
We came to check your work. Let me see how many persons you got now that I passed today.
Since the reopening of the borders between the Ebola-affected countries, some of the checkpoints are not only manned by border officials, but also by health volunteers. They question anybody wanting to cross from Guinea into Liberia and measure their temperature. Those with a fever or other Ebola symptoms are sent back to Guinea or escorted to the next clinic. These so-called triage are only placed at the official border crossings. But there are many ways to get into Liberia, and a lot are not monitored.
There is no way that we can stop people from crossing the other border because of the kind of porous border we have. Even though people are going to dodge us to get into our communities. But when they get into our community look as strange people to elect us.
In a village not far from the border, Emmanuel meets a traditional healer. The villagers crowd around Novai Batekpa, a small podgy lady, and the surveillance officer.
So the reason why we see her in common, that one of our zoo, we all know her. So people can come from different places to come to her. So she and all need to work together.
Women like Novai are the first point of call for any sick person in the village. The next hospital is usually far away. Often the villagers have more trust in their traditional medicine, especially when the illness is believed to be down to witchcraft. During the height of the Ebola outbreak last year, stories reached the news that traditional healers had denied the existence of the virus and had treated Ebola patients. As a result, they not only got sick themselves, but also infected others. So Emmanuel never gets tired of sensitizing the villagers and the healers about how to recognize the signs and symptoms of Ebola and to prevent the spread of the disease.
So when she's touching people, she needs to use gloves. She needs to wash her hands. We don't want to lose her. So when you see people, you're not sitting far away. You just call the people to the border, your own children, then yeah, then they will call us.
Despite the good news that the treatment centers in Liberia are empty and that the country currently counts zero Ebola cases, Emmanuel is skeptical. As long as there is one case in Guinea or Sierra Leone, Liberia is still in danger.
Because there is a time that people will feel relaxed. And Ebola is still in the region. So once you feel relaxed and somebody comes in, forget it.
But today Emmanuel's words seem to fall on fertile ground. The healer Novai at least claims that she does not treat her patients directly anymore. They now have to rub themselves with the white chalk, her treatment against all possible ailments. So all in tune with the no-touch policy that Liberia's health workers have been preaching since the beginning of the outbreak.
Laura Salm Reifescheid reporting there from Liberia's border with Guinea. You're listening to DW's Worldlink. I'm Neil King.
And I'm Natalie Muller.
Different colors and with different grades and different people.
You're listening to DW's WorldLink, bringing you the personal stories behind the headlines. In Bonn, Germany, I'm Natalie Muller.
And I'm Neil King. In this part of the show,
100 years after the Armenian genocide began, we hear the story of an Armenian grandmother who kept her identity secret to escape persecution.
Soldiers reflect on the fall of Saigon 40 years after the end of the Vietnam War.
Plus, Linda, the stray dog turned movie star in Chile.
One evening I was here and I was looking at her and, you know, my job is to come up with stories. So I'm thinking, imagine if she could tell me what happened to her in all this time when she was wandering in the city.
Those stories and more coming up in this edition of WorldLink.
This week marks a century since the Armenian genocide began during World War I. Up to 1.5 million people from the Ottoman Empire's Armenian minority were slaughtered or forcibly expelled at the hands of Ottoman Turkish forces between 1915 and 1917. As many as 200,000 Armenians are thought to have survived the mass killings by assimilating, changing their name and identity and converting to Islam in order to keep their roots a secret.
And in many cases, their stories remained a secret for decades, unknown even by their descendants living in today's Turkey. But slowly, more and more Armenian survivors are starting to speak up and share their experiences. And as Dorian Jones reports from Istanbul, their stories could open a way for people to come to terms with the horrific events of the past.
Fethiye Çetin found out about her grandmother Seher's Armenian identity and her real name, Haranush, when she revealed it just before her death, when she was 70 years old, when Haranush asked her granddaughter Çetin for help to find her relatives living in the US. The request revealed to Çetin not only a lost family history, but one of Turkey's darkest chapters.
I found out about my grandmother when she asked me to find her sister and relatives who were living in the US. From that moment on, I learned that she was a Christian Armenian, that she experienced the genocide as the child of an Armenian family, that she made the long walk of death and was taken as an adopted daughter by a Muslim family in Turkey.
Çetin admitted she knew little about the mass deportation of Ottoman Turkey's Armenian minority and their subsequent killings, which much of the world described as genocide, a charge Ankara vehemently denies. But for Çetin, the fact her grandmother had felt compelled to hide the story from her for more than 60 years made her determined to publish the story, My Grandmother.
I wanted her story to be written because it wasn't possible to talk about the 1915 genocide in Turkey. Nobody was listening to one another. With my grandmother's story, it was a human story. I wrote this book in order to say, look, all these things happened and this is a true story.
Historians estimate that around 200,000 Armenians, mainly children and some young women, survived the deportations and mass killings of 1915. But what happened to them remains untold, part of the country's silence over those events. Çetin, being a lawyer, knew the risks of publishing such a book back in 2005. At that time, saying there was an Armenian genocide would mean you'd be put on trial and would probably face years in jail. Instead, Çetin's book became a bestseller. Çetin believes the very personal nature of the story was the reason it escaped prosecution and became a success. But it took a tragedy to open the door further to other Armenian children's stories. In 2007, Çetin's close friend, Haran Dink, editor and founder of the bilingual Turkish-Armenian Argos newspaper, was gunned down outside his office by a Turkish nationalist. Within hours, thousands of people, both Turks and Armenians, gathered outside the paper chanting, "We are all Haran Dink, we are all Armenians." Those words continue to resonate today, nearly a decade after his death. Pakrat Estukian, editor of the Armenian pages of Argos, says the response to Dink's death opened the door to empowering people to discover their past.
This was a slogan for solidarity. We knew that these people were not all Armenians, But I think converted Armenians, who knew about their past and who even talked about it, took this slogan a bit differently. They suddenly became visible. This was an interesting development. Nobody was aware of it, and this created a break in the political climate in Turkey. The slogan got a big positive reaction.
The Argos newspaper is now one of the first places many people come looking for help in trying to discover the full story of their Armenian past. According to Yedvard Danzakian, Argos chief editor.
There is a new trend in Turkey to explore an Armenian grandmother, for example, or when going to any conference or seminar in Anatolia or Ankara, always two or three person came and said that last year I learned that my grandmother was an Armenian. But of course she lived as a Muslim and she died as a Muslim. And they say my father and the mother didn't tell me. We know that 200,000 Armenians must be a Muslim in genocide. And more people face to some stories and some realities, which is, in fact, proof of genocide, in fact.
Documentaries are now being made portraying these Armenian orphans. A scene from Nahide Turkusu, or Nahide's Song by Berke Bash. Bash made the film about her Armenian grandmother, Nahide, who as a young child was saved by Bash's family, initially hidden under the kitchen sink while marauding gangs of Turkish militia searched for Armenians in the Black Sea city of Ordu. Nahide's brother was shot and killed during the pogrom. Bash says she always knew about Nahide's Armenian identity. But until making the film, she never really understood the enormity of the story. She says exploring such family stories offers a way to come to terms and comprehend the magnitude of the genocide.
It's such a traumatic experience in the lives of these people. 1915 is not a very, very far time. It is still in the memories of the people. There was this traumatic experience, same for Turks, because they faced the dissolution of a society that existed for hundreds of years together. There could be clashes, there could be disagreements, there could be prejudices. But I know they were shocked that it came to an end. My father always says that. Yeah, it's like before it was a different city. So this trauma, I think, is settled in people's mind that they don't want to express it. You hide it, even like just to forget, as if like retelling, you would live that moment again.
Çetin still spends much of her time talking to others about her grandmother's experiences. She says with more and more stories of the hundreds of thousands of assimilated Armenian survivors slowly coming out and being talked about offers hope for the future.
Müslümanlaştırılmış Ermeniler konusu.
The issue of converted Armenians has helped talking about 1915 in a more open way. No one brought a single court case against me for writing the book. This problem unites all of us. The state is still insisting on denying the genocide. But the society is very different. It is more dynamic and more inquisitive. That's why I think the society is starting to change.
The Turkish government is continuing to fight ferociously international efforts to recognize the Armenian genocide with threats and angry denials. But with more and more families in Turkey discovering the tragic stories of their hidden Armenian ancestors, the hope is that their legacy can offer a path for the country and people reconciling themselves with their history.
Dorian Jones reporting there from Istanbul.
While finding out about their family histories has given some Armenians a way to face the genocide, the truth about what went on in 1915 is still being hotly debated in Turkey. The Turkish government rejects the term genocide and insists the Armenian death toll was much lower than reported and that just as many Turks were killed during wartime unrest. Modern Turkey emerged in 1923 after the collapse of the Ottoman Empire, and the events leading up to that point have become part of its national identity narrative.
More than 20 countries have recognised that the systematic extermination of Armenians amounted to the first genocide of the 20th century, but Germany had long resisted using the G word, mainly to avoid harming diplomatic ties with Ankara, but that changed this week.
The fate of the Armenians serves as an example of the history of mass extermination, ethnic cleansing, expulsions, and ultimately the genocides that so dreadfully characterized the 20th century.
German President Joachim Gauck broke with German tradition by using the word genocide at a service this week to commemorate Armenian victims in Berlin. Germany's government has also backed a resolution calling the killings genocide.
To find out what this change means, we spoke to Alex Chan, who works with the Central Council of Armenians in Germany. He asked that we not use his real name for personal reasons. Alex was born in Turkey before moving to Germany as a teenager. We began by asking him how he responded to the news Germany was finally recognizing the genocide.
Well, first of all, I think it's a very important sign that the German parliament is now willing to go beyond the terms of the massacres and or forced displacements and so on, and instead wants to use the term genocide. And if you are a traumatized person because you just have this history, and you have the feeling of just have to defend yourselves, even you are living in somewhere else, it just hurts. So it is a huge step for the Armenian people and the other ethnic people that Germany does that, who call Germany now their home.
How would you describe the wounds or scars that remain for Armenians today?
There is something like a transgenerational transmission of the wounds, of the scars, of the genocide. Most of the Armenians everywhere in the world has family members who have survived that, so they are mostly, that's their heritage. And in most of the families, most of the people, if you talk to them, they have heard it when the elderly people just came around and once a year or twice a year, and then they started crying and they started talking about the events that they had been through.
And in your family history, do you have relatives who were affected by the mass killings?
Yes. On my father's side, my great-grandfather has survived the genocide. He was 8 or 9 years old. His father has been killed, and his mother survived only because there was a Kurd who wanted to take her as a second wife. And wise as she was, she told him that she would work for him for 2 years without any compensation, and for that he should not marry her. That was how they survived. On my mother's side, we don't actually know the events. They have also been killings, but some of them have survived because they had forcefully converted to Islam first, and then after they converted back to Christianity.
And how old were you when you first became aware of that history?
I guess I heard the first stories about all what happened when I was 10 years old. And it took me a very long time to just start reading what really happened and in which context, in which areas and so on.
You were born in Turkey and you left Turkey when you were 13, I understand.
Yes.
How did this impact your view of your friends, the Turkish friends that you had, or your Turkish environment? I mean, did you develop a certain hatred towards Turkey or the Turks?
No, I just want to emphasize, I do not feel any hate against the Turkish people. I sometimes do feel anger about all that what happened, and it is very complicated to build up friendships with Turkish people, but I also had one good friend who was Turkish. He never denied that there was a genocide.
And what about the Turks in Germany? I mean, there's quite a significant minority of Turks in Germany.
Yes.
Have they got a different take on the genocide than their compatriots in Turkey?
Well, the friend I was talking about it now was in Germany. It was not the friend in Turkey. In Turkey, we could not speak also with the friends about the genocide. You cannot speak openly about the genocide. You will get hurt.
What do you think would it take for reconciliation between Armenians and Turks to begin in earnest?
I don't think that there can be a reconciliation without some kind of common truth about the history. It is about how the Turkish society thinks. For a real reconciliation, I think the Turkish society has to evaluate its history and has to find a more accurate narrative of the foundation of Turkey.
Many thanks to Alex Chan, who works with the Central Council of Armenians in Germany.
Another big anniversary being observed around the world this week is the fall of Saigon. On the 30th of April 1975, Viet Cong and North Vietnamese troops captured what is today known as Ho Chi Minh City, forcing the South Vietnamese government to surrender.
The end of the Vietnam War 40 years ago marked the start of a transition period for the Southeast Asian country, eventually leading to the reunification of the North and South into a socialist republic. The occasion, officially called Liberation Day, is usually marked by several festivals. Marion Brown travelled to Ho Chi Minh City in the south and Hanoi in the north and found out not everyone is celebrating.
Amid the deafening sound of traffic noise and construction work in Ho Chi Minh City, the country's largest metropolis and economic hub, platforms and lights are being assembled for official performances to mark an important date in the country's history, the end of the Vietnam War. Known as Liberation Day in the north and Black April by others, not everyone has happy memories of the day. On the morning of April 30th, 1975, a tank belonging to communist troops rolled through the gates of the presidential palace of the city, which up until then was named Saigon. Later that day, the President of the Republic of South Vietnam officially announced their surrender. Speaking from a street-side cafe in Ho Chi Minh City, 67-year-old Nguyen Van Hoang reminisces about the day he heard the news.
I was an officer for the Republic of South Vietnam. I fought from the first day to the last and took part in the two biggest battles for South Vietnam. On the 30th of April, I was stationed at a battlefield in the city highlands. I was sitting with my men when I heard the president on the radio, and I surrendered. At the time, I was only thinking about my men. People say the bullet escapes you, not you escape the bullet. It's all about destiny.
2 years after the signing of the Paris Peace Accords and the withdrawal of US troops allied with South Vietnam, Saigon was renamed Ho Chi Minh City after North Vietnam's revolutionary leader. After the war, Hoang, like thousands of other veterans from South Vietnam, was sent to a re-education camp.
There was a department called Taking Care of the Soldiers. They told the veterans from the Republic of South Vietnam to go to re-education camps. I was there for 2 years and 11 months. They didn't let me do anything. I felt like I was floating between the earth and the sky.
Over 1,700 kilometres away in Hanoi, Nguyen Duc Gan, also 67, has a different angle on the day that changed his country and his life. Gan was a North Vietnamese soldier during the war. He was taken prisoner in 1969 and kept in a notorious jail on Phu Quoc Island until the Paris Peace Accords were signed in 1973. The day he received the news from his commanding officers, he was convalescing in a camp outside Hanoi. Proudly dressed in his military uniform and sipping a tiny cup of green tea, he recalls the day the South surrendered with enthusiasm.
On the day South Vietnam was liberated, all the soldiers were very happy. At the same time, we weren't surprised at all. We were soldiers often facing death during years of war. We were always sure that sooner or later we would win. We soldiers always thought we would win against the US. In my heart, I always knew we would achieve reunification.
Gan says he believes the date should be celebrated, but in a way that would help Vietnam and the US become closer. Despite that, he hasn't changed the way he thinks about the war.
During the war with the US, I thought the government of the South was just a puppet of foreign nations to fight against the people of Vietnam. Since the war, I haven't changed my mind. I still think they were a puppet government working for a foreign nation.
Hoang says he does not dare to wear his uniform in public. He says life was extremely difficult for veterans like him after the war because they were not allowed to get government jobs. As time went on, things improved, but he says he still feels like a second-class citizen, especially on anniversaries like April 30th.
I want to help my old friends and see how they are living now. When we talk together, we understand each other. We were comrades in arms, so we understand each other. On the 30th of April, I will feel sad,
because I'm separate from normal people in society.
Marianne Brown sent us that report from Vietnam.
And now to Chile, where film director and screenwriter Sergio Castillo is making the country's first movie starring a dog. And it isn't just any dog. His film is all about Linda, or Perla, as she is known in the film, a stray dog he found wandering around Santiago.
Castillo has been making films and documentaries in the US, Europe and Chile since the 70s. And before he met Linda, he had been having a tough time coming up with ideas for his next project. Jane Chambers went to meet him and asked him how he decided to cast a dog as his leading lady.
I was a little bit on a hole because I had returned to Chile. My mother was in a home. She was not in the best health. She was quite senile. And I couldn't leave her alone. So I stayed here. I tried to make a movie here. Two of the projects fell apart. And I was like, what am I going to do next?
Okay. Then, one evening, Sergio was walking home when he saw Linda, a stray black and tan dog with beautiful brown eyes.
She looked at me with her eyes, the eyes you've seen, and I looked at her, and I said, let's go. And I brought her home, and she lied down on the couch exactly where I'm sitting, and she went to sleep, but her sleep was agitated and anxious, so I realized that she was in trouble emotionally, and I couldn't leave her alone. I left her alone one day, and she brought down all the curtains, and she tried to make a hole and underneath the door, the entrance door, and she destroyed the rug. She was afraid. She couldn't be left alone. She thought she was going to be abandoned again. Of course, when I decided that I had acted in an impulse, I realized a month later that it had not been such an impulse. It had been sort of a very thoughtful act because 15 days after I had adopted her, my mother died. A couple of weeks later, I realized a little bit within some introspection that I had adopted her because I didn't want to be alone. My two grown-up children don't live in Chile. I was divorced, and at the time I didn't have a girlfriend, so I was alone, and I didn't want to be alone in this loss, the loss of my mother.
Buscaba una historia que contar y no encontraba nada.
It's one thing to adopt a dog, but it's quite another to decide it's going to be the subject of your film.
One evening I was here and I was looking at her and, you know, my job is to come up with stories. And as I said, I was going through a blank and two productions that fell apart. So I'm thinking, imagine if she could tell me what happened to her in all this time when she was wandering in the city. And I thought, if she could tell me the stories, it would be a good movie. And I started thinking like that, but immediately I abandoned the idea because I said, well, how am I going to do a movie with one dog when in reality to make a movie you need at least four dogs who look alike and can play the part in case one has a problem, could that be an accident? So I said, it's too risky. I can't do this movie. I felt I didn't know enough to do a movie about dogs. I didn't know enough about dogs. I didn't know how to shoot them, how to work with them. So I dropped the idea. But 2 weeks later, the idea came back, and I dropped it again. 2 weeks later, came back again, until I decided that I'm going to give it a shot.
De Quiltra Callejera a estrella de todas las pantallas.
The film takes place all over Santiago and has various flashbacks to Linda's past life. But at the heart of it is her relationship with her new owner, Samuel, a struggling screenwriter, and his relationship with his elderly mother and estranged daughter. Samuel is played by the film director and screenwriter Sergio. But just how close is the film to his real life?
In a way, I did not make a verbatim story of my life, but I picked up elements. And my mother didn't have a father, and I didn't have a father. So it's a trend sometimes. I didn't abandon my children, and I didn't have a daughter. So in a way, the daughter in the movie is my mother, and I'm her father in a way, So it's in a sense, of course, it's sort of biographical, but worked out. So I raised some money, I had some savings, and I decided to go for it. And I thought that the dog was going to be the attraction. I also realized that the dog situation in Chile had become very much a national issue.
There are so many stray dogs all over Chile. And unlike in other countries, they aren't taken off the streets and put in dog homes or destroyed. Sergio thinks they symbolize a sense of abandonment that typifies what's going on in Chile.
In Chile, there's an abandonment issue. I mean, a lot of fathers abandon their children. They divorce their mothers or they separate from their mothers. And I think in Latin America, there's a chain of abandonment that it's hard to break.
Sergio has teamed up with various dog foundations and hopes that the film will make Chileans think about how they treat stray dogs and improve conditions for them. But just how did he get the star of the film to play her part so professionally?
Somebody recommended a trainer, and I called the trainer. And really, the trainer trained me how to treat the dog. Just by watching him, I learned a lot about dogs. For example, the first scene we were shooting in a hill.
Una noche que caminaba hacia mi casa, encontré una perra abandonada. Le puse Perla.
This is when she's abandoned by her owner on right. San Cristobal Hill, and he takes some food, gives it to her, and then kind of goes off on his right. Jeep.
And I said, how do I know she's going to come back? I was very worried I was going to lose the dog. So that must have been my main worry. And he said, no, you're not going to. She's going to come back because you treat her nicely. She's got a home. She knows that. She's going to come back. And she didn't come back for 20 minutes. I said, why do I have to listen to the guy? Why did I start making these movies so ridiculous? Blah, blah, blah. So finally, the dog came back, and we had to take two. So take two, what are we going to do now? So she left for 3 minutes, and I knew that she was going to come back. So little by little, I started trusting her and believing what she could do. We started bringing her to places and see what she would do. And then, for example, the soccer match she's in, it was totally improvised.
Linda went to a park and started to play with other dogs.
I took her there because I knew there were dogs there. And suddenly she's with a bottle and she is playing with the other dogs and scoring and you know, and going for it. And was very, very improvised. I never wrote a scene. I knew what the scene was going to be about. And I knew the emotions involved in the scene. But I didn't write any dialogue or I didn't have a shot list. I just shot as we went along and improvised. Of course, in the editing was very difficult, extremely difficult, because we had a lot of material, and we didn't. I went in this direction, and I short stories that went in this direction. So finally, we cut the movie and put it together, and it sort of made sense.
Linda has completely changed Sergio's life. He's a lot happier now, and the writer's block is over. He plans to make a film about his mother and what life was like for her during General Pinochet's military dictatorship. And it looks like Linda's thoroughly enjoying life as a star. When I was watching the film in Sergio's flat, all she wanted to do was to play with me. She kept putting a smelly sock on the sofa and looking at me meaningfully. And throughout the entire interview with Sergio, she kept trying to lick the microphone. So I think it's only fair to let her have the last word.
So, Linda, I want to know something. Are you hungry? Yes?
No.
Would you like a bone? Would you like me to give you a bone?
That was Linda or Perla, ending that report by Jane Chambers.
And that also brings us to the end of today's program. We hope you enjoyed the show and we'll tune in again next week for more personal stories from around the globe.
WorldLink was produced by Neil King and Natalie Muller. Our sound engineer was Gert Georgi. And if you'd like to hear these stories again, you can go to our website at dw.de/worldlink. WorldLink is brought to you by DW in Bonn, Germany.
I love my dog as much as I love you. But you may think my dog will always come through. All he asks from me is the food to give him strength.
All he ever needs is love, and that he knows he'll get. So I love my dog as much as I love you, you.